This is the Florida Spectacular Podcast with your hosts, Kathy Silustri and Rick Kilby. Keep up with Kathy at greatfloridaroadtrip.com and on Twitter and Instagram at Kathy Silustri. Find Rick at rickkilby.com. Now, discover a Florida you never knew existed.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to this week's episode of Florida Spectacular. How you doing, Rick?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I mean, I almost lost a foot this week, but I'm getting better.
It wasn't that bad, was it really?
It was not that bad at all. So those of you listening, I had a very unusual spider bite on my foot that got very big very quickly, and I made the mistake, or maybe not, of posting it on my Instagram. And apparently it looked like a nipple to some people. So this generated a lot of conversation. And then my friends who remember the time I was stung by a stingray and wouldn't go to the doctor kind of sort of started texting me going, you know, you really need to get that checked out. Remember the time with the stingray and the infection line? And so the dermatologist said it was a spider bite. I was correct. And that keep taking the antibiotics that telehealth gave me, and I was probably not going to lose the foot. So thus ending the saga of nipple foot. But anyway,
the legend, it's a legend now.
It is. It's the legend of nipple foot. It'll be a children's book. We'll get it on Netflix. It's going to be great. But we have somebody on the podcast this morning who was on the group podcast, the crossover we did with Florida Madcaps, back at the Spring Summit in February, which doesn't seem that long ago, but gosh, it was. TJ Frederick, welcome to the podcast. TJ is with Save the Manatee Club. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Well, you heard. I mean, you know. But
you said it was over, so.
It's over. I'm great. I'm doing fantastic. I was telling our producer before we opened the show, we had a young blue jay flying around our house this morning. So I feel like I'm really channeling my Dr. Doolittle in a lot of ways right now. It did have a moment when I was bit by a spider this week. My friend Shelly actually was bit by a pelican while she was kayaking. And
that's
our friend's
backstory.
Well, the pelican had a broken wing.
Oh.
And she was trying to help it. And of course, she was kayaking. Her wife was in the other kayak and had their little French bulldog in the kayak. And that little dog was going nuts. The pelican didn't like being held. Was injured and also did not appreciate the little bulldog in the next kayak. So it was trying to get away. And yeah, now pelicans do not hurt you when they bite. They just kind of clamp down. The only time it hurts is when you pull your arm away, because then the side teeth have little razors. And so she pulled her arm away. But you know, her thing, you know, she has been attacked. We joke that she's been attacked by all these seemingly harmless Florida creatures because she is deathly afraid of manatee. And she swears, and I've seen it happen. She'll be kayaking, I'll be kayaking with her, a manatee will surface, and I swear they hiss at her. And so since you are the expert about manatees, is that a thing? Do they actually hiss?
No, manatees don't hiss, but when they come up and they take a very deep exhalation of air, it can sound kind of like a hiss. It's a whoosh kind of noise.
And so it's not aggressive.
No, it can be very startling for sure, especially if you're not expecting it. But
well, I can see that.
Right. If it's all quiet and you're hearing birds and all of a sudden right next to you, you hear a whoosh noise.
The first time I saw a manatee in the wild, I was in a college class and we had gone canoeing, and my then boyfriend, college boyfriend, was in the back of the canoe. I was in the front. We were on the Alafaya River, and he kept steering us into either side of the riverbank. So we had gotten way behind the rest of the class, and we started arguing because I kept saying, "You're the one who steers." He's like, "No, the person in the front steers." And I'm like, "No, the person in the back steers, the person in the front." And so while we're having this argument, I guess this manatee just got tired of it. And all of a sudden, this big tail fluke just slapped down in front of us. And man, I screamed. The rest of the class came kayaking back. I don't know what they thought happened. It was amazing, but it was also slightly terrifying if you don't expect it. So yeah. So I can tell her they're probably not tracking her while she's kayaking.
So manatees are very curious naturally. And if she is the only thing around, I wouldn't be surprised if a manatee would be kind of watching from a distance. But it's very easy to hear that exhalation of breath. I mean, when I'm out there paddling for fun or in the field, really, I often hear manatees way before I see them.
Yeah.
So they don't really need to be that far away for you to be able to hear it. But I wouldn't say a manatee is tracking her with any ill intent. They aren't aggressive.
I will let her know.
What are their teeth? They grind plants, right? So they don't have any sharp teeth, right?
No, they do not have sharp teeth. They actually have, so they use their teeth, but also they have their palate is also used to grind up the vegetation, but they don't have any teeth that they would use for biting like a predator.
I saw some video this actually yesterday of them eating the leaves off mangrove trees. I never knew that they ate that before. I thought all they ate was in the water.
That's one of my favorite facts about manatees, that they will eat hanging plants, and it's really cool to see them use their very strong pectoral fins to get out of the water, to either launch themselves up a little bit or even sometimes pull themselves up on the banks to grab those hanging plants. In an area where you see a lot of manatees in the mangroves and maybe there isn't as much grasses nearby, you'll see that the entire bottom of mangrove forests, so all the leaves are gone.
So does it hurt the mangroves, or they have enough leaves that they can handle that?
I don't know if there's ever been a study that looked into the impact of that, but it's only the bottom, very bottom part of the mangrove leaves. And there are quite a lot of other leaves on the trees. And I've never seen a mangrove die from that.
Yeah. I think that's an area for somebody's thesis, master's or PhD thesis.
I feel like there are more pressing threats to the shoreline and mangroves than
the manatees.
You know, a lumbering, farting manatee just trying to get a little salty treat.
I'm also a big fan of the disturbance theory, which is that any type of disturbance in the wild, I mean, everything has evolved to exist around hurricanes and other animals coming in and eating leaves. And so a lot of times we have herbivores come in and eat leaves, and that encourages new growth from the plant. So it likely does improve mangrove production in some way, but it would be small. And you're right. Whether you want to define an entire thesis on that with everything else going on.
Wasn't there a group, I think, in Crystal River that was trying to make the argument that manatee poop was contributing to the decline of the water quality in the springs? And it just seems so preposterous to me, you know, like, Crystal River or Homosassa or those places that get lots of manatees. And do you remember hearing that?
Oh, I've heard that not just in Crystal River. I've heard that. And I think it's a lot easier for people to point at an animal and say, everything that's wrong in Florida is the manatee's fault, which don't take that out of context, because that's not true, versus the number of people moving to Florida, the impacts of pollution on the aquifer, runoff, and all those other things. And it's very difficult to conceptualize that, but it's a lot easier to point at one, you know, scapegoat and say that that is at fault. But manatees have evolved to live alongside these aquatic ecosystems for thousands of years, and their waste is part of the nutrient cycle. It's not the cause of any of this loss of seagrass or the impacts we're seeing to water quality. That is human-made, human-caused.
That's hard to believe. Humans causing a problem, that would seem wrong.
Florida, of all
no.
places? Never.
Well, you know, my big thing with manatee is that we like to think of them as these sweet, gentle giants. But I've had one experience where they did, you know, startle me in the water, which I realized was not their fault. And I told you when we did the podcast, I was feeding the tarpon down at Robbie's in the Keys, and I was holding down the little bait fish. And this manatee pushed the tarpon out of the way and grabbed the fish. And it was just this horrible moment where I'm like, well, that was aggressive. And it was a combination of that was aggressive, and I didn't know they were omnivores. And also, I just violated federal law, and I didn't mean to. Like, it was like a very weird moment, because you think of them as not being tenacious. You know, they're almost painted in the media as like these victims of everything. But you talk about them being able to propel themselves out of water to get the mangrove leaves. And I mean, they're not helpless. They look kind of floofy, but they're not helpless creatures, right? They do have means.
Oh, for sure. And humans have a way of taking things and kind of making them more docile in our brains. But at the end of the day, these animals are huge wild animals that do have biological needs. And while they might not be acting, you know, aggressive in the terms of defending a habitat, they can throw their bodies around. And it's well known for scientists that participate in the health assessments, where they will capture animals and work them up and determine how they're doing as far as their fat thickness and take blood samples and things, that these animals are very large and we need to be careful when we're bringing them on the boat, and, you know, to keep our legs out of the way and be ready to potentially hop off the boat at any moment's notice if something were to happen, because they're not just complacent creatures. They have a lot of muscle and a lot of weight behind them.
Have they ever hurt anyone?
I mean, I the horror movie fan in me wants that answer to be yes.
Like like Sharknado, shark, however
Manatee
you say
Nado
it.
Or something. Yeah. No, but have there been any manatee-related human deaths?
Not that I know of, but I haven't read every, you know, incident report. I know that, you know, we do get a lot of boating accidents, and those can be from people hitting manatees and can cause significant damage. But as far as manatees aren't flinging themselves out of the water onto boats like some of the needlefish that you hear about, you know. It's
Kathy, I'm getting an idea here. I think we got an idea for a screenplay.
I'm all in. Tell me, we need to have a drop bear version of the manatee here in Florida. You know, drop bears, the what people in Australia will tell tourists, that there are koalas with incredibly sharp teeth that'll drop out of trees and attack you. Here, so that people give manatees their space. I think we should be giving manatees their space anyway, because they're wild animals, but, you know, maybe some type of something like that.
I am all in for it. I mean, I think that, you know, the best thing you can do is scare people a little bit. I hate to say that, but we tend to be kind of jerks. So I think if we're a little scared of things, it's probably not bad for us to be a little scared of things. You know, it's I'm okay with it.
And, Where was it? Silver Glen? Yeah, Silver Glen, December, like 23. It was just me and the manatee. And it was a little intimidating because it was just so big. You know, and you're sharing the space with this enormous creature. And I think that's what hit me, you know, the biggest, you know, the biggest impact I had was just the size of the animal that I was with. And it, I definitely wanted to keep my distance as a result of that. So maybe I have a little manatee fear in me.
I mean, I remember years ago, Barry and I, my husband and I did a manatee eco tour, which in hindsight, I'm not sure how I feel about it, if I would recommend it or not, but we went up to the Crystal River area and we got on a small boat, and, you know, they do a really good job, TJ, of trying to pretend that it is all about education, but there was no lie. We were all there to pet a manatee. And I just remember getting out of the boat, and of course it was the summer, so the manatee, you know, all the pictures they show you of the manatee experience are the manatee in the springhead with the crystal clear water. Well, the springhead is chilly, and in July they're not in the springhead, they're in black water. And I remember getting out of the boat, and I mean, we really couldn't see what we were touching. It could have been a gator for all I know, but it was massive. The only reason I don't think it was a gator is that no one died, but I remember feeling like it was just such a massive creature. And I'm not necessarily recommending that anybody do what I did, but it just seems like the sort of thing that we've anthropomorphized these animals so much to be like these cute, lovable, cuddly things, but they could, you know, just very easily, if I would imagine, if they thought there was a threat to their young, they would try and do anything they could to protect them. And you're right, that is a lot of muscle. Even if it wasn't muscle, it's a lot of fat. I mean, 800 pounds, right? Is that a pretty average weight?
That's on the smaller side.
Okay. Wow. Well, okay. 1,000 pounds. Imagine 1,000 pounds of fat or muscle thinking you're going to hurt its baby. I mean, I think.
What I will say about a manatee is their behavior is, if they or their child, their calf, were in harm's way, a manatee's first instinct is going to be to flee. it's not going to be any type of attack or anything like that. They can burst at speeds up to 18 miles an hour. The issue we see a lot of the time is that harassment of the animal being disturbed and needing to flee in areas like Crystal River is that it's happening constantly all day. So the animals are using energy that they would otherwise be using to, you know, nurse their calf or find food or stay warm or rest to avoid people. And in the long term, that causes a lot of stress to the animal, can cause them to leave an area that otherwise would be a healthy habitat for them, put them in harm's way. So it's less that they're, you know, going to throw themselves at people and more that they're getting this treatment every day, all day. And like you said, the visibility in the summertime in Crystal River is poor.
You know, I noticed.
And there, it's a double-edged sword and a fine line to walk, because a lot of people care about manatees because they were able to see them in the wild in Crystal River and have that experience. And now they want to share how important that was to them with their loved ones and spread the message of conservation. But a lot of the time we're seeing that these tours are causing harassment, because how can you get in the water with an animal and give them enough distance so that they're not disturbed by you when you can barely see them? That it's just not a reality that exists.
No, I get that. And it's, you know, it's a phenomenon that we have with wild animals. If we don't perceive them as dangerous, we want to cuddle them as close as we can. And I don't know if that's something primal in our brain, but it's to the animal's disadvantage usually. There's not, other than puppies and some cats, I don't know of a lot of animals that love to be cuddled. Like gators, not cuddly.
There's something about humans, and you know, I'm guilty of it too, where when we see something that we're interested in or we really enjoy, we want to touch it. We want to be close to it. There's something about proximity that makes us feel more connected with things, like being, you know, I've been to museums and seen people touching the ancient artifacts. There's just something about the brain that says, I have to touch it. You know, even if we know that that's not what's best for the animal. I don't think people even really consider that when they're out there. I think most people, when they go out on, you know, an eco tour, they expect that their guide, whoever they're with, knows what's best, and they're going to follow whatever they say. And if the guide is saying, well, you can get within, you know, this distance, and if the animal comes up to you, you can do this or do that, they're just going to trust that they're being told the correct information, because why wouldn't they?
Fair enough.
They're not going out of their way to learn what they should be doing on their own, because they've already done that part when they booked the tour or whatever. It's, you know, extra effort on their part, which is why it's so important to us that we, you know, partner with ecotour groups and teach them the sustainable paddling methods and the ways that they can best educate their guests, because the guests aren't getting it on their own. They're trusting their guides to give it to them.
And they sometimes maybe should not.
That is also true. Not everyone has the animal's best interests or your best interests at heart. And that is just true.
It's, you know, they're really amazing creatures. I almost want to say they're like a evolutionary leftover, but they're really not. I mean, I feel like all marine mammals freak me out a little bit because they're sentenced to spend their life in something they cannot breathe. So dolphins, turtles, manatee, I kind of feel a little empathy for, like, you know, you need the oxygen and you need air to get the oxygen, but you're in the water all the time. So I feel like they're always already at a disadvantage. And then you add to that, and maybe that's just in my head, they probably don't think about it that way, but you add to that five people getting off a boat and swimming over to them, and it must just be a very stressful experience.
Not being able to escape, I can't imagine what that must be like, to be, you know, in a cove or something, and all of these people hop in the water and now you can't feel like you can't get out of the way. But I will say, it is a terrestrial point of view to think about manatees as being trapped and you know, having to breathe. As a swimmer, you know, who's been in the water my entire life, I honestly feel most comfortable in the water and wish I could be in the water all the time, even knowing that I would need to come up to breathe. But a manatee is adapted to, you know, be their best selves, essentially, in the water. They have they're streamlined the way that they have evolved over time to be able to travel these huge distances at, you know, a slow pace, and being an herbivore, the way that they, you know, use energy, they are adapted. They're a great example. The thing with Florida is that we get a lot colder than some of the other areas manatees are typically found in. So like in the Caribbean, manatees don't have to deal with that winter cold snap, and our manatees here aren't adapted to survive those cold snaps, which is why they have to gather at the warm water sites in the wintertime.
How far north will people find manatee?
In the winter?
Or in the summer? Or both?
So when it warms up, manatees will go as far north as Massachusetts.
Wow.
It's not a huge number of them. And every manatee is different. They will have a different home range. Some animals will only travel within, you know, a couple of rivers, a couple of habitats within Florida their entire life. And some manatees will consistently leave Florida in the summertime. And so some of that is just, you know, adaptation, their curiosity for the environment. We have animals that are regularly going into the Carolinas every summer to feed and then come back. And they go as far over as Texas as well. And we've actually had manatees.
Why would anybody go to Texas?
A barbecue.
We've had manatees go to the Bahamas too, from Florida.
Wow.
So they're made to travel these huge distances.
Where's your best place to see them in the summer? In Florida, of course.
In the summertime, the best place, I would say, areas where, you know, there's going to be mating herds, but that you'd want to stay out of the water because mating herds can be very dangerous. You can see a lot of mating herds at the Haulover Canal in the Mosquito Lagoon by Merritt Island. You'll see them, but it's when you know more, when you look at it, it actually ends up being pretty sad because they're doing these mating herds, these huge mating events, but they're in the boating canal where there is no slow speed zone because you can't get through it without hitting a certain speed. So that it's very dangerous for them. But in the summertime, really, they only gather to mate. There's a lot of them in Tampa Bay as well, but offshore, we get a lot of our sighting form. We'll get sightings from the middle of the bay of manatees in mating herds or just out there feeding on the seagrass beds. But a lot of time this summer, they're out feeding during the day.
So we did a boat ride on the St. John's, I guess it was just last week. And the guide, he was very well-intentioned, but he kept dancing around what the manatee were doing. And he finally admitted that it was mating behavior. And I'm like, you know, that's not a dirty word. Everybody here at some point is the product of people mating. But it's never something I thought of as dangerous. You said mating herds can be dangerous. And
yes,
I'm not trying to turn them into fearsome creatures, but
no, this is important to know. And FWC will put out information about this every year. So manatees mate year round, but their mating is suppressed in the wintertime. So even though we're seeing hundreds of animals gather in these warm water sites, it's very uncommon to see successful mating. Manatees will do mating behavior without actually inseminating a female. But
Whoa. What is mating behavior?
So a mating herd, you'll see animals rolling around, climbing on top of each other, tail slapping. Typically, there's one female and any number of males, but you can have 12 or more even that follow a female around for weeks at a time. And when the female is receptive to mating, everything will stop and kind of simmer down for about a minute or two, and then they'll disperse. So in the wintertime, it's common to see males doing those behaviors without a focal female or without the actual final mating present. It's thought that they're just suppressed during that time. But then in the spring and summer, we typically see mating herds in full force. And during that time, manatees only have one thing on their mind, which is mating. So they will be following the female and not pay attention to where they're going. So in the middle of a boat channel. But these are, as we said, 800 to 1200 pound or even more than that, you know, animals that are all slapping and rolling around. And so, one, it's important to avoid them with your boat, but not try to paddle and get too close because you can get swept up in it. It is dangerous because these are large animals. Not that they're going to attack you, but they just are not paying attention to you at all. So
our screenplay is getting more and more clear to me. I think there's so many opportunities here. I see hybridization and crossbreeding and all sorts of fierce things that could happen.
I'm not going to make TJ talk about it again, but I love that. I love that she just kind of very nicely said the mating behaviors are there without the focal female present. And I just, you know, I don't want to be too woke or anything, but I do love that we see that humans are apparently the only mammal that seems to have a problem with fluid sexuality, I guess is the best way to put it.
Well,
because
it's more fluid. That it's more that there are technical terms for specific acts, and I don't want to get too into the weeds of things and not have the correct terminology for everything.
It's fair. It's fine. No, I mean, it's just, I like that.
But listen, I'm the first one who's on the bank of the river and kids go, well, what's that? And I go, oh, that's their penis. That's me.
Awesome.
Right? I have no issue with that. because that's what's happening.
It's not abnormal, right?
Yeah, it's not. It's natural. It's how we get more manatees. It's what we hope for.
I mean, I guess in that vein, we want to see a lot more manatee penis because they've had a bad run, especially in Indian River Lagoon. How are the populations doing?
See the calves. We specifically.
Well, yeah, but you can't see the calves without seeing the penises, or at least knowing the penises are present.
Yes.
Oh,
I love talking about animal behavior. I really do, because animals are so pure in their motives, aside from dolphin, which we're not going to talk about today. The manatee, I like how you say they're not going to try and hurt you, but they're just, I mean, you basically describe them as like a college boy. Like they've got one thing on their mind and that's it. They're going to roll you over. They're going to just push your kayak out of the way to get to the female.
So I've gone swimming in Crystal River, and it is totally common knowledge that there are horny males that will grab onto you because they want, that's what they want to do. That's what they are doing.
Females or just any human?
Two people. They are grabbing onto people.
I've heard of that in dolphin behavior. I didn't know manatees did it. Boy, wow, that took a turn.
the movie just got an X rating. It was weird. This is great. We share information on this podcast. Manatee are kind of a thing. I am 52, and when I was a kid, you did not see them. I mean, they have been increasing in number, but I think there's been a couple of significant events lately that are actually harming the population. How are the studies showing that the manatee population in Florida are doing?
It depends on the area of the state you're in, and things are always in flux. So sometimes we'll have some years where things look good and something will happen and things will look bad. So starting around 2020, we were having those mass mortality events in the Indian River Lagoon, where we lost over 1,000 animals in 1 year. And about the way that we consider manatee management and their population in Florida is they're split into four kind of subgroups: the Atlantic coast as a whole, the Northwest, the Southwest, and the St. John's River. And it was estimated that we lost about 14% of the entire Atlantic coast population from that. Bad, but that's because there was a significant loss of seagrass along the entire Indian River Lagoon, which is 156 miles long. It makes up 40% of the entire Florida East Coast. So manatees historically have depended upon this habitat having grass. And over the last decade, we lost over 30,000 acres of seagrass. So manatees were starving. We've had grasses start to come back, especially in the northernmost part of the Indian River Lagoon, the Mosquito Lagoon, the Banana River. But there are areas of the Indian River Lagoon, especially the middle, like by Titusville, those areas where We've just done so much damage, and like the causeways that cross the lagoon reduce flow. So we just have a lot of issues with flow of water into the lagoon. There's only 5 inlets. So the nutrients just kind of sit there. And then when there's an algal bloom and the algae dies, it sinks to the bottom and creates muck. And then the muck just sits there and nothing can grow in it. So we have these patches in the Indian River Lagoon where nothing can really grow. So there are a lot of different nonprofits, agencies, universities, they're all working to restore the lagoon. And there's been a lot of work on restoring water quality, which is why I think we've been seeing this. We've been seeing grasses come back. Brevard County has the half-cent sales tax, and they've been taxing themselves to do stormwater infrastructure projects and seeing real improvements from that, which has been really wonderful to see. So things are on the upswing there, but there's also been a lot of funding coming in from the governor to help support those projects. And
that's encouraging to hear.
Yeah. So there's positives happening. In general, the entire world is seeing a decline in seagrass due to rising temperatures and human development. So it's one of those things where people might say, oh, we have a lot of manatees. Do we need to keep doing this? It's like, well, we only have them because we're doing this. And as soon as we stop, you know, actively trying to fix what we've done to the environment here, we're going to lose it. So it's not like we've made it all the way back yet.
Well, it's encouraging to know that the state's doing something. What can people do?
So if you live in Florida, all of the water in Florida that we consume, that we use, comes from the aquifer. And even if you don't live on a waterway, when you fertilize your lawn, that eventually will end up in a stream, a river, or in the aquifer. So you don't need to live on a water body to impact our fresh water here. So we always recommend that you don't fertilize. It's pretty much unnecessary. And the soils in Florida aren't made for it. We have a lot of karst limestone. I mean, the reason we have the aquifer as it is because the water, you know, can go directly through the stone into the water beneath our feet. So being aware of that, and also your water use, explaining to people in your life why it's important to you to care about the water here, and also about caring for the environment. I think making your opinion known, especially in the political climate we have now, is an act of rebellion in itself, to say that you care about something that you're being told you shouldn't care about. Is really can go very far.
Okay. Well, I mean, I think you're talking to two people who, I don't know, you don't have any fertilizer in your garage, do you, Rick?
Yeah. Well, I don't have a garage, so.
Well, so, but yes, I've seen your landscape.
There is no fertilizer, and I have a sign that says my yard is manatee free for the manatees that you guys sent me. It blows over my front yard, so it's kind of in my side yard, but I keep it up because I believe, you know, we don't, like everything you said, we don't need fertilizer. And I try and, it's either Florida friendly or it's a native if it's in my yard. So,
yeah, everything in our yard, we used to call it landscape Darwinism, but we had a problem with torpedo grass, so that doesn't work anymore. But we, fertilizer, there's no reason, well, first of all, there's no reason to have turf grass. There's no scientific reason to have turf grass. It is a lie that's been sold to us by, you know, Big Turf and the Europeans. It came over from Europe. And when we had a revolution, we let go of everything except the damn turf grass. But that's a podcast for another time. I want to get back to the manatee, because a little bit of a tangent, and I probably should have asked you if you could speak to this. I am fascinated by a 1990s book by Douglas Adams and Mark Carradine, and I think I say that name wrong, called Last Chance to See, where they went around the globe looking at endangered animals. And one of the animals they looked at was the Amazonian manatee. And they talk about, there's this 20-year period, because this was also a show on the BBC. And if you go to Mark's website, it will tell you, this is the status of the animal at first, this is the status of the animal now. And if for the Amazonian manatee, I think it's not good. Do you have any, I mean, I realize Save the Manatee is largely dealing with Florida manatee, but the Amazonian manatee looks a lot like the manatee we have here. And there was an estimate in 1988-89 of 8,000 to 30,000. And then when they went back in 2008-2009, it was the same estimate, but they said there's strong evidence that the numbers are decreasing. But the issue there, the first threat to them there is actually hunting. So I didn't know, how are the, do you know how these two manatee are related? Because gosh, they look similar.
So there's a lot of questions you had in there.
I know. I'm sorry.
That's okay. So the Amazonian manatee is smaller than the Florida manatee. There's actually three species of manatees in the world. So we have the West Indian manatee, which is broken down into the Florida manatee and the Antillean manatee. Then there's the Amazonian manatee, which is in the Amazon River Basin, and the African manatee, which is along the west coast of Africa. And for both the Amazonian and the African manatee, they have a big problems with hunting, for subsistence hunting. These are areas that aren't as developed, right? You've got the Amazon River Basin, the Amazon Rainforest, right. Areas where people don't have access to, you know, other means of making money and supporting their family. Manatees are protected. It is illegal to hunt manatees everywhere that manatees are, but it requires giving people other options on how to support themselves in order to move away from that. So one of our partners, over in Cameroon has been working with the locals there to transition them away from subsistence hunting and actually helping to support research and going out there and looking for signs of manatees. Also over there, it is very difficult to see manatees. So, and in the Amazon as well, the water is turbid. So you're not seeing crystal clear waters like we have here, and dense cover of rainforest. Sometimes the only sign that a manatee has been around is to find feces, to find any proof that there has been an animal in the area at all. So it can be very difficult in these areas to determine how many manatees there are, because it's really a guess. And that's even difficult in Florida too, because when they do the aerial surveys, when they're flying over, there are still manatees down at the bottom. There are manatees under mangroves. You can't see them all. But I do know that the Amazonian manatee, there in just the last couple of decades, there are so many wonderful researchers who are out there doing genetics work, and they're expanding their rescue networks so that local governments and law enforcement can be trained on how to help rescue these animals. It's uncommon that these animals can actually be rescued and rehabilitated because they don't have the facilities for it. So, or they don't have the training that we have here. So it, you know, having those partnerships with people in the U.S. who can help train their staff, or these larger marine mammal conferences so people can share information. There's definitely a lot more information about the Amazonian manatee than there was even 30 years ago. Something that I think is very cool is through genetic studies, they've seen the Caribbean Antillean manatee and the Amazonian manatee are hybridizing. So they know that they are reproducing together, and they're seeing hybrids of the two species. Which is, I think, very cool.
Hmm.
Wow. Okay. Well, good. Then I didn't catch you off guard by asking. I felt bad, but I'm fascinated by, there's actually a documentary on Amazon. It's through the documentary channel you can buy through Amazon, where they went to the Amazon and talked about it. And they talk about how the hunting is illegal and the fishing, and absolutely what you said, that water is turbid. Like, I don't know how they manage to hunt manatee in that water. Like, it's, what do they do? Hook a head of lettuce? Or, yeah, tell me, but I'm not sure.
A big hook and a head of lettuce.
A big hook and some romaine. A
giant sinker.
No, tell me. Tell our listeners. I'm sad, but tell us.
Well, now I'm, you know, I'm pretty sure that they will target the calf.
Oh.
So what is actually very common is you'll find that people will call in a calf that they found, but they've taken the mother.
Oh my God.
We'll get rescued.
Okay. Yeah. I wish you hadn't told me that, but
you don't have to include it in your podcast.
It's in the podcast. It's in there. It's in there now.
It's in there. If we have to know it, listeners, you have to know it.
See, you know, I was going a whole other direction. I was thinking that, you know, there's piranha and killer bees and all this stuff from South America. That's going into our screenplay, that there's these killer manatees with razor sharp teeth that somehow hybridize with ours and migrate up here. And maybe that's...
You know what you also need to is that, you know, manatees, true fact that they have the marching molars, so they're constantly replacing their teeth. So when you say that manatees have, you know, sharp teeth for your... for your movie
screenplay. Yeah. And I think that's part of it. And there's definitely it has to be a reaction to something man does. Like, you know, there's this bad chemical that gets in the water that causes DNA.
Fertilizer.
Yeah.
A new type of fertilizer.
New kind
developed
of fertilizer.
By what's the phosphate company that Mosaic.
You said it, not me.
Well, they're not going to sponsor the podcast. I'm fairly confident that I am not Publix, Mosaic, a few others are probably never going to come knocking. I feel fairly confident that.
Can I put in two plugs so we can put them in the show notes?
Yes.
I'm sure you've probably seen this, TJ, the video that Leslie Gamble shot on Mostly at Blue Springs called Swimming Through Air, that has the it's on the Springs Eternal Project website now. It's the opening scene is a manatee getting closer and closer and closer and closer to the camera till basically its teeth are right there, you know, and it gets
awesome.
It's just wonderful. And in the soundtrack is Delius's Florida Suite that was composed on the St. John's River. That's something I want to make sure we get in the show notes. And then the documentary that Jacques Cousteau did in the 1970s, which was really pivotal, I think, in creating awareness of the manatee. I forget what it's called. It's something about mermaids.
It escapes me now.
Yeah. And he talks about, because, you know, when I was a kid, there was no awareness of manatees. I do think, you know, they were here. You just didn't hear about them. And he did this thing, and a lot of it was shot at Blue Springs in Volusia County in Crystal River. And he talked about how, you know, they found manatees with rakes in their back and all this kind of stuff because people, you know, didn't care about them, you know. And, you know, I've seen these historical photos where people in Florida used to hunt manatees, and there was actually postcards of them. And it sickens me. But that documentary did a huge favor in creating awareness that manatees are here and deserve protection. I'd like to put that in the show notes too.
What's the name of the mermaids?
Pardon, what is it?
The Forgotten Mermaids.
The Forgotten
Thank you.
Mermaids.
Yes, we're putting links to all this stuff. We're putting links to the I'm actually putting a link to Disturbance Theory because I had never heard of that before, and I looked it up real quick, and it's fascinating.
Isn't it fascinating?
It is.
Ecology, so that's
But we're putting links on how to report a manatee sighting. Obviously, I'm putting a link up about the Amazonian manatee and how to catch that documentary, Swimming Through Air, how to join the Save the Manatee Club. I mean, that's just even something. Would you rather have people join, or would you rather they do the license plate? Do you know which one?
So the license plate doesn't go to us.
Then you would rather have people join.
I think that people should support manatees in whatever way speaks best to them.
Manatee mailbox. You got to have a manatee mailbox.
This doesn't support the manatee. They hate the caricature.
The license plate supports research for the state. So population model monitoring and things like that. And then funding for us, we support those efforts as well. And we have our own conservation initiatives that are ongoing. A lot of what we do, as well as working with local governments, state, federal agencies to help support the work that they do, is we advocate for stronger protection. So if we see gaps in conservation, like more data needing to be collected or issues with not having enough voter education, we try to identify any of those gaps across the state and see how we can kind of bring partners together to work to fill those gaps.
That's awesome. And you also have an annual Save the Manatee. It's not a swim, which is disappointing, but probably harder to do. You have a Save the Manatee 5K every year, right?
You can do your 5K however you want. So you don't have to run it. And there's a virtual option as well.
Awesome. Yeah. So that's always a possibility. It's virtual, in person, and there's tons of ways to support the work of your organization, which we really appreciate you being here today, talking about everything from fertilizer to manatee members.
That's what I should be calling it.
The member. It sounds like a Harlequin, you know, a Harlequin romance there. Anyway, not going to write that book. But as somebody who is just completely in love with how many wild animals I see in Florida now as compared to when I was a child, I really appreciate the work you're doing. And I understand that these animals really are under constant threat, but little tiny changes people can make help too.
Something that a lot of people don't realize about the manatee world is that there's so many people doing incredible work, but a lot of that work just doesn't get spotlighted because that's not the kind of people that work in marine conservation. They're not talking about that. They're not, you know, because the work, it just feels like what they have to do every day. So I'm always very appreciative when I'm able to talk about, you know, the folks at FWC or the different zoos and aquariums that are all, you know, helping to rescue and rehab these animals that, you know, do that work out there every day. It's hard work and they don't get any praise for it. And it's important, like that's what keeps me coming back to the job, you know, other than how important it is just knowing that there are people who care as much as I do out there doing the work.
I think there's a lot of people who care. I mean, yeah. It's just sometimes things can feel so overwhelming and hopeless that we feel powerless. So that's why we always like to remind our listeners, you don't have to. Well, Rick and I probably both very much wish you would rip out all your turf grass.
Yes, please.
But even if you start planting a little more that doesn't need fertilizer, or, you know, $5 a month to the Save the Manatee Club, or just, you know, be, most boaters know this, but it's going to fall on deaf ears if they don't, you know, just don't be an idiot while you're boating. And yeah, I doubt any idiots are listening to us because we only have the very smartest, the very brightest listeners.
This is an idiot free zone here.
It is.
It's a no wake zone and a manatee member zone too, I'm afraid.
It is a manatee member. And also we'll be announcing the GoFundMe for our proof of concept for our Manatees Ravage Manhattan movie that we're working on.
I love that. Yeah, if they get to Massachusetts, surely they can get to New York, right?
Yeah, but they don't want to. Because what we didn't talk about, how smart they are. They don't want to go to New York. Manatees do not.
But if they're really pissed, they will.
Well, I mean, if there's a manatee NATO, like a shark NATO, then yeah, it could happen.
Yeah, yeah.
But I feel like this is probably not why TJ went to college, was to talk about manatee B movies. Although, isn't there one being produced?
I was going to say that if we have angry manatees, it's because they're from New York. As a New Yorker, I think that.
Coming down to Miami with an attitude.
Exactly.
You know, the water in New York is the best.
Oh my God. As a New Yorker, I cannot, I hate to identify as a New Yorker because I was born there, but I got out so soon. But yes, I could totally see that. Like, you know, this romaine, the romaine we had back in Yonkers, man, it was, no, New York has the best absolute romaine. The stuff down here, it's the water, it doesn't taste good. And we just lost the New York segment of the podcast.
I mean,
that's
they're
okay.
Talking about, you know, those manatees, they're talking about how the traffic here is nothing.
Oh, yeah. You've never driven in Manateehattan. And, you know, don't even get them started on the pizza and the bagels.
I'm seeing spinoffs now. I think this could
there's
be
a whole
franchise.
Thing.
I'm telling you. Just
Sci-fi,
the Burt's
if
potential.
You're listening, call us. now, there was a 1997 movie, and we will close out with this. Attack of the Killer Manatee. And I just want to read the description of the plot because it is adorable. Teens on a camping trip find the old road to a boat ramp has been mysteriously removed. They trek through the woods, because of course they do, until they find where the road picks up again. When they get to the end of the line, they find a nuclear power plant now stands in the once pristine wetlands. They boat out to their island campsite. Strange and mysterious things begin to happen as one by one, the teens meet their fate. So another description says nuclear runoff from a nearby power plant has transformed the native manatees into savage, bloodthirsty creatures with an insatiable appetite for humans.
I'm crushed. It's been done.
I think it could be done better. This one involves a robot companion. You know, it's, I'll put the link in the show notes, but I don't even see where we can stream it, very honestly, which is.
So it's not even a B movie.
I mean,
It's like a D plus.
Usually IMDb has like a where to watch, and it doesn't for this one.
Oh, well, that's exciting.
I know. Anyway.
You know what? It says it's unreleased. You should try to get it released. I think you should use your, you know.
Oh, where was it filmed? That's the big thing.
Well, that's the problem. There's so little information. I'm trying. Wes Horn. There's no photos. I recognize absolutely none of the 9 top cast members who have names like Tent Boy, Tent Girl, Nuke Man 2, Scott and Sharon and Ben and Jen. It doesn't really say.
I think I got a feeling
filmed.
That the Tent
Tampa Boy- Bay, Tampa Bay.
So you need to find somebody over there who worked on it. We need to get this. Maybe a Florida Spectacular Film Fest.
I am down for it. We have a lovely, lovely 1939 theater that is finally reopening on St. Pete Beach this summer. It's the Beach Theater. It was opened in 1939, same year as The Wizard of Oz. And then there was a wonderful guy. He worked on The Punisher. He owned it because he lived in St. Pete Beach. And when he died, it was under dispute with his ex-wife. So it's been closed for years, but apparently it's reopening this summer. I think we could do a Florida Spectacular Film Fest.
And the debut of the Killer Manatee movie. It just sounds great. You know, basically I use this podcast just for brainstorming. It's just like a, you know, a live brainstorming session where we come up with ideas that we're never going to actually follow through on.
You don't know.
We
you don't know.
Know. We don't
know. It could
know.
Happen.
Kismet could happen. We could be putting things in the universe now that are actually going to come to fruition. I hope.
TJ.
Fest.
I hope that when you get your annual review with Save the Manatee Club, they do not hold up this podcast and go, look, you talked about manatee penises, killer manatee, and what exactly is it you do here? Like, please, please, please. Thank you so much for being on the podcast. You've been very informative, and we really do appreciate it.
It's always a pleasure to chat with you.
If you can say that a third time, it'll be great. All right. Well, folks, before we go, as usual, we want to thank our paid listeners, our supporting cast, if you will. We picked up, I believe, at least one new one this week. So we want to thank, and Stephanie, thank you for giving me the pronunciation of your name, Stephanie Hewley. Brad Sager, Brian Woodall, The Betts Boys Adventure, Elise Smith, Carol Miller, Leslie Hallweg, Davita Breyer, Natalie Zachrick, Angela Connolly, John Bound, Ryan Worthington, and Marco Gargulak. And remember, if you are supporting us at one of the higher levels, which means $10 a month, if you are supporting us at that level, which we call our Orange Blossom Special, you have a special perk heading your way in the mail. That'll be coming at you soon. I got a little behind on my mailing, but thank you for your support. If you're listening and you have even $1 a month, $3 a month to support the podcast, Rick and I certainly appreciate it, and Florida appreciates your support as well. So thanks for listening, and we will see you next time on the Florida Spectacular.
And let me just add, if you listen to this before May 10th, Kathy and I will both be at the Floridiana Festival at the Matheson Museum in Gainesville, and there will be a meetup afterwards. Stay tuned for details.
Pizza
will be involved.
Sorry.
And I would just like to say no manatees were harmed during the recording of this podcast.